Long ago? Oh, my God.
Hello. Testing 1, 2, 3, 4. Hello.
Are these spotlights a bit warm? Or are you okay?
It's okay.
I'm thinking maybe if we turn the spotlights off. Actually, I turned them off earlier, but they came on again. My Ben Pepnia Chai, Logan Nidoi. Muganiga Tug Lao, Machai, Ig Yang Nun. So with guy, do you see them? Okay, we'll leave the lights, see what happens. Thank you all for coming. Welcome to Arya Som, if you haven't been here before. This is a small hotel, very nice small hotel, and David here and his wife have this facility especially for doing Dhamma events and having monks stay here. So we're very glad to be able to have Rinpoche stay in here overnight before he travels on leaving the country tomorrow morning. So thank you very much for the facilities and the great Dhamma space that we have here. I think everybody knows the website and has the contact information, so I'm not putting out the leaflets and the sign-up sheets. I think you can find your own way to the website. If you're not sure, you can ask me or someone else afterwards. So this is our last event with Mingyu Tulku Rinpoche. Very nice to have him here over the last couple of weeks. And we're very grateful for his energy and willingness to come and do a whole series of Dhamma talks for us. We have a couple of things left over. We were going to talk about, one was the story about from Tolstoy, which we were owed. And there was another one about something, story? You said earlier, Rocky Mountain. Okay, you said earlier you had another story for him to say.
I was just thinking they wound up your driving lesson.
Huh?
Your driving lesson.
Okay. So we had these two, and we also were thinking about the topic on the dying, mm-hmm. how to die gracefully. Mm-hmm. But we'll leave the topic open to yourself.
Okay.
After having a couple of weeks here in Thailand, what kind of things or advice would you have for the people here? Not everybody has been to your talks before, so some people this is the first time.
Okay.
So if I can hand over to you, Rinpoche, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. I owe a lot of thanks to the Reverend Kamit for organizing most of my events along with Andy. And I'm especially grateful to Derry for allowing us to use his premise, his evening. I had a very good impression of Thailand. I think it's a very, very nice place, a country to live in at this moment. People are very kind, and food is excellent. Food is especially delicious. Weather is very mild. What more do you need? And there is peace. And kindness, you know, kindness is so important. if people are kind to each other, I think that's the most important thing. And preventing flukes, you know, the one who plays the flukes. And he plays a very nice flute. And then he plays it in very, you know, big events like UNO and, you know, Nobel Peace Prize and things like that. And he always makes one prayer, just one prayer. And he says, may all beings be kind to each other. I think that actually is enough, you know, if all beings are kind to each other, we have more or less done away with most of the man-made problems. So kindness is so important. And especially the kind of actions and thoughts and kind of speech, you know. And speech, how important the speech is, we sometimes don't realize. Because it is said that, you know, the words do not have the, you know, edge, sharp edge. But it can cut somebody's heart into pieces. It's like that. You know? So it's very, very important. So therefore, I find it so much in my life. Everybody is so respectful to each other. Of course, you know, everybody is feeling some side, so there has to be problems. There has to be weaknesses, but it's a very, very special and good quality. The topic about death, you know, it's not just about death. The whole teaching is not just about death. It's about the future from now onwards. Because those people, whether it's Buddhists or Hindus or Jains or, you know, most of these religions, spiritual traditions, who believe in a life after life. And then, you know, the future becomes extremely important. You know, this life is just a very small segment. And what happens, good things happening, not so good things happening in this life, is a very short time. And what happens afterwards is very, very long time. So therefore, you know, this is the general understanding that what we have to think about is more for the long term than for the short term. And also believe in the karma. Action and its reactions and causes and effects. Then, you know, what we do now becomes extremely important for the future, not only for the experience of dying alone, but, you know, for at the time of dying also, and then, you know, what happens after that, what happens after that. And all the time, you know, from that onwards. So therefore, you know, this life becomes extremely important and valuable because it is said to be like the time when we can actually, you know, maybe a little bit manage or decide which is, you know, which direction we go for our future. So therefore, it's the time when we can actually do something, especially as a human being who has this special faculty, this intelligence, who has lots of power, lots of freedom to do things, and also the capacity, special capacities to think, special capacities to understand, to learn, and also to prepare ourselves in such a way that we can actually make it happen on ourselves. So therefore, it becomes a very, very important time for our future. That's why, you know, most of the people, like Buddhists, talk about, you know, death and, you know, importance of death. Importance. It's not just about the death itself. It's about, you know, all the time after that. Not just this life, but the lives to come. So therefore, you know, this kind of idea of what, you know, so of course, you know, therefore, what can we do? What shall I do? What is the most important thing to do in this life becomes very important. So actually, when we talk about the death, how to prepare for our death, it's not really, you know, just at the moment of death. It's more about how should we do, what should we do, what should be our attitude and way of looking in our life now at every moment, so that the life can, because life and death are very, very interrelated. When we talk about, especially Buddhist life, sometimes people ask this question also, you know, if there is a life after, then what is it that goes from this life to the next life? I think some people even already asked this question. What is it? The person asks, is it the consciousness or something? I don't remember now. And I said the consciousness. I didn't explain too much because I just wanted to end. But you know, in Buddhism, there is something which sometimes people find a little bit confusing. We talk about anatta, you know, like selflessness, and then we talk about life after life. So they say, if there is no self, then what is it that goes from life after life? And this sounds very contradictory. Either there should be self, or there should be no life after life. This has to be understood in a context, in the right way. If you understand in the right way, actually it is not contradictory, it's complementary. What it says is that when we look at things, anything, it's not just I, but anything, there you find that there is nothing there which is only, you know, independent. The existing on its own, where we look into, you know, a thing like, you know, water, for instance. What is water? Water, when you go down to the more kind of minute level, is basically, you know, oxygen and hydrogen. And when there was one professor who did research on that in Ireland. He said that when you take apart the oxygen and the hydrogen, then there's nothing in it. It just disappears. When these two things come together, then water appears. So it's like magic. So in the same way, I think most of the things, it's not that. It doesn't have a independent existence. If you go deeper and very minute, but it appears, but it is there, and that's from, you know, from Buddhist point of view, says is empty. The form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. That means what it means. If you look deeply, there is nothing there. But it doesn't disappear. You don't find an essence of existence on its own. Does not make it disappear. It all appears, and it all changes, and it all grows, and it all remains because of this special quality of the way things are. And same is me, my consciousness also. If you look deeply, where is it? What is it? What is its color? What is its shape? What is it, you know, where exactly it is? Can't find. The human consciousness is like that. But, and if you look at me, it's also like that. We say I, but what is I? The body. In the body also, you know, it's just made of many cells. Which cell is it? The brain. Which brain is millions of cells. Which one is that? There's no one thing, you know. Even they say, the scientists say, when they make the examination of the brain and any kind of experience happens, they say that you cannot find exact location. It's not exact location. So therefore, it's like that. There's nothing you can find, but is there. Awareness is there. Consciousness is there. There's nothing that can be totally eliminated. And so it is not eliminable, and it is totally, you know, kind of, it's nothing there, and it's appearing. That's the way everything is. That's the nature, the whole nature of everything is like that. So therefore, if it was there on its own and totally independent, then it could not continue. It is not possible to continue because it couldn't change. There is what, you know, continuation means changing, affecting each other, you know. Life is what we live because things change. When something grows, then, you know, things are changing all the time, and therefore it's growing. If it is not changing, it cannot grow. If things are not changing, it cannot decay. If things are not changing, it cannot die. But then it cannot grow again. Because there is always change, because there is always, you know, there is no kind of existing on its own. Therefore, it's always, you know, in a process. And that process is the life. That process is the way things happen. So therefore, you know, because there is no self, therefore it's possible to, you know, to continue. And because there is no self, therefore it is a flow, therefore it continues. And there is nothing which can stop that, because it's the nature is to flow, to change, and to continue. And so therefore, you know, the problem is that we do not understand that. We always think this is me and I am like this all the time, and this is not, should not change. And you know, if something changes, then if it is what I like, then it's okay. But if I don't like, then it's very bad. You know. So therefore, you know, this is what I nice should not go away. This is, you know, this is a nice flower, it should not decay. You know. But if the flower doesn't grow and doesn't fall down, the next flower cannot come. Then we don't kind of look at it. So therefore, our only problem is not, the change is not a problem, but our way of looking at it, our way of grasping, our way of, you know, kind of reacting to that is the problem. So therefore, you know, every moment is a change. Every day is a change. Every year is a change. Every life is a change. And so that is nothing so special. It is just another change. So when we can be confident about it, it's not enough just to say, oh, there's no problem, it's just and then we do all sorts of negative things in our life. Then, you know, it's a very important change. It's a very important change because, you know, there's lots of, you know, it's a crucial kind of moment for us. How we act at the time of death, how we react at the time of death, how we, you know, carry ourselves at the time of death, makes lots of difference for the next moment, next life also. And not only that, but from Buddhist point of view, especially from the Vajrayana point of view, we talk about Bhargo. The Bhargo is a transition. The transition. And the transition is always, you know, it's not just at the time of death. It's always in transition. So therefore we talk about four bhargos. The life itself is a transition. Life is a bhargo. So, from the moment we are born to the moment we are about to die, is what we call the bhargo of life. And it is very important, very crucial transitory stage. Because this is the time, and each of these, that's one transition. Then from the time of, you know, starting to die, that means, you know, all our four elements start to fall apart in our body, till our consciousness goes blank. That's the dying process. That's another bhargo, the bhargo of dying. Then from that onwards, you know, till then we talk about the bhargo of dharmata, that is, you know, when our consciousness gets into our the most subtle, most kind of, what can you say, the deepest level of our being, the subtlest experience, and then it kind of comes back to more our experience of the becoming experience. That period is called Adho Dharmata. And then from that time onwards, when we, our karmic experiences kind of come back, then to the time when we are complete as the next life, let's go. And until we are about, you know, in the complete and also in the process of birth, till we are, you know, born, that stage is called the till we are about, till we are complete, you can say. That's what we call the Adho of becoming. So these four Adhos keep on, you know, and but then the understanding is that each of these Adhos, each of these transitory stages, it's a cycle. Cycle, we just make the divisions just, you know, to indicate special kind of transition, but every moment in the transition, the cycle of transitions. And so each of these transitions is a very important opportunity. This is the main understanding of the study and the practice of the Mahārāja of the head. That each of these four transitory stages is a very, very important opportunity. And each of these levels, if we are wise enough, if you work in the right way, if you have the right understanding, we can get totally free from our samsaric state of mind, and we can, you know, we can do a very important thing for our future at any of these stages, not only at the time of death, not only at the time of after death, not only in our life. Life is one of the most important things, because now we have the freedom to do what we want to, and freedom to train how we react. So if we can learn to act, you know, and react with compassion, with kindness, and know what we are, what our, you know, what the nature of things are, what the nature of my mind is, what the nature of my consciousness is, what am I, you know, who am I, what am I, if I really see it, then, you know, it is possible that we do not need to have so much fear of the changes, so much fear of what might happen to us, so much, you know, so when we have not, when we understood this, the way we are, the way our consciousness is, in a more clear way, then, you know, our kind of need to be so much, you know, worried and feared and thereby clinging and casting is becomes not necessary. And that, you know, that kind of experience of understanding happens, then there's no problem. There's no problem for living. There's no problem for dying. Because, you know, living we can be extremely joyful because there's no need of any fear and there's no need of any action or blasting. So therefore, there's no problem for death also because there's no need of any fear and there's no need. So therefore, when we really realize that we are nothing more than the river, and the river cannot be, you know, killed, because there's nothing there. There's nothing there to the damage. There's no wanting with this me. So therefore, there's, you know, it's like that. So there's nothing in my consciousness, awareness, or in my subtle mind which cannot be changed, which cannot be killed, which cannot be, you know, destroyed, because there's nothing there. So therefore, it appears, it keeps on appearing, it keeps on, you know, manifesting, because there is no one real, true, you know, independent thing there. So therefore, it keeps on manifesting. So when we understand that, that is the most important thing. That's what we call, from Buddhist point of view, realizing the nature of self. Sometimes we call it understanding the selflessness. It's just the words. To understand selflessness, to understand the self, is the sense. Once we have that understanding, then, you know, it's no problem in the life, and there's no problem at the death. Therefore, it's the best preparation for the death. And not only for the death, but for all the lives to come. Now this understanding can happen in our lifetime. It is possible, but it is also can happen at the time of the death. Especially if you have some understanding, some teaching, some experience, some meditation in our lifetime, then when actual death happens, when actual death experience happens, then you realize, that there's, you can actually go through this experience of time. And so therefore, we have no more fear. So you go deep into this consciousness, and then the subtlest consciousness, and you have no fear, and you have no. So there, there's actually no problem. And you realize, more clearly, more clearly through experience. This is it. And because that time, the body, the elements, the body dissolves. So therefore, your mind becomes clear. Your mind becomes goes into the deepest level of our experience. And when our mind is able to recognize, then it's like it's sometimes called like meeting the mother luminosity, the meeting of the child and the mother luminosity sometimes. Because what we have understood or what we have heard about, what we have had some learning or knowledge or some kind of intellectual understanding or a little bit glimpse in our meditation now becomes completely experienced, because it is actually happening and it's totally experienced. And when that happens, then sometimes people who die go into deep samadhi. This is what is said to be happening to the people who at the time of death sometimes goes into meditation, and after death remains like that for several days or sometimes even several weeks or sometimes longer. So therefore, this knowing that the time of death, you get into this experience. And then when you come out of that situation, when the path of Dhammata happens, then again all the energy of the consciousness comes out, and then all the experiences of colors and sounds, sometimes it is explained or talked about as rocking and peaceful beings, but it is not all kind of fearful experiences, the forms and light and sounds and things like that. And sometimes peaceful meaning light, forms and sounds and things like that happening. But when if you can realize at that time, if all these things happening to me, it's my own mind. It's the manifestation of my own mind happening. So therefore, there is nothing I need to run away from or run after. So when we understand that, all these experiences that I go through are, my own radiance. So therefore, there's no need for me to run away from or run after from. It's on my own. So I see it as something pure, as something my own. My own kind of shadow or reflection or radiance, then they all turn into something positive, what we call sometimes deities, Buddhas or teachers, whatever you call it. There is nothing there that's going to harm. It's like a dream. So therefore, these are, when we can realize this, that state can be also a liberation one. So this is what we call Dhammata. And after that, if you don't, if you don't get liberated there, then again the path of becoming happens. And then also, then we come back to the experience of of our lives before. Then, you know, you see maybe your body, maybe you don't see your body. You see your, you know, your relatives, they're crying, or you try to talk to them, but they don't talk to you. So you are doubtful whether you are dead or you are not dead, and you know, and then all the life things go through your experience, because it's like, you know, in one moment you kind of go through all your life experiences, you know, past life and things like that. And then you are sometimes very frightened, you are sometimes very angry, you are sometimes, you know, very sad because you are now dead and things like that. And at that time, if you realize that there's no need to do that, because, you know, there's nothing, you are not, you know, what you are is not, you know, not what you have been, not the body, only the mind and the mental body. So therefore, whatever you think, you are there. So you think about, you know, the Buddha field, and you are in the Buddha field. You think about it, you know, heaven, and you are in heaven. So, you know, wherever your mind is concentrated, that is where you are. So when you realize this, then there is no need to panic, there is no need to be afraid, there is no need to be, you know, trying to hold on to things. So therefore there is another chance to be liberated, to be totally free. And this is a big, important thing. So therefore this kind of, you know, Tibetan Book of the Dead is all about this, you know, the introduction of these different stages. So that's when we know that, then when those experiences come to us, then we can recognize them and, you know, then say, oh, this is what it is now. I'm at this stage. So now I have to do this. It's not necessary. So therefore this understanding, as I said, to be extremely important. Because sometimes just hearing them, just knowing them, these are the stages. When you get actually into that experience, you immediately realize, oh, this is what, you know, what I heard, what I said, things like that. And if you can really realize that, you can really transform at that moment and sense. That's why sometimes these kind of teachings are called the liberation by hearing. Because even if you just heard it, it can sometimes help so much that when you actually experience that, so you can really pass on. So therefore these are, you know, when somebody dies, sometimes that these, you know, introductions are laid out by sometimes the lama, or sometimes the own family member, or something like that. So that, you know, if the consciousness is still around, then it can be a kind of a reminder. And instead of getting into the, all sorts of negative emotions, or bringing negative emotions of anger, things like that, you can look back and then get the bliss. So this is, you know, this is the main kind of teaching on. And of course, everybody has to die. This is the whole point. Nobody to have a vision of only for that. So therefore everybody should know these things. And also, you know, it's important for people who die themselves, but it is also important for those who are behind, so that they can also, you know, learn how to help the person to die or this day. Because sometimes people who are, you know, we always lose our dear and near ones, and we don't know what to do. At that time, there's nothing we can do. So therefore, if we can, you know, this is the idea, that if we can remind them that they can be peaceful and not, you know, create lots of negativity and emotions and things like that, but peacefully allow them to go and say goodbye in a very positive way. Because, you know, from the Buddhist point of view, we are bound with karma of countless lives, so we cannot be totally separate. We will meet again and again and again. Sometimes in a nice way, sometimes in a not so nice way, maybe, but, you know. So therefore, you know, that's not really completely kind of finished, you know, the relationship. But in order to help somebody, if we can breathe to them, you know, sometimes at that time of death, it's very important that, you know, of course, how you act and how you react in your life and how you are, you know, used to what your attitude tendency becomes the most important thing. But sometimes at the time of that, exactly, you know, what kind of emotional state, what kind of mental state you are, is also very important, because that, you know, that creates the next moment. So, you know, so therefore, there, when the people, you know, the family members, the friends, and things like that, can help by, you know, being positive, by sending positive thoughts, kind thoughts, and mind messages, and also reminders of what to do and not to do in the time of the battle, and things like that. So these are the, you know, these are the kind of battle stages, practices. Sometimes people find lots of rituals, but the rituals are mostly not really, you know, kind of the things, but more of all these the reminders and things like that. So, so that's the that's generally about the death and karma. And what is it that we have to do in the lifetime? Now, you know, if we can understand the nature of our nature of the phenomenon, then we have the wisdom. That's the nature. So therefore, but then if that is not possible, at least we can do something that is positive, something that is good, something that is, you know, that's healthy. And sometimes if you ask, what is it that's good? What is that? What can I do? That, I think, is that story becomes relevant now. Tolstoy story. I mean, I think it's not really that Tolstoy made this story up. There was a story, and he wrote it down, I think. So the story is like this. There was a king, and I think it is in Japan, it looks like Japanese king. And then he was, you know, the king was kind of, not only intellectual, but kind of spiritual. So he was asking his three questions to all his, you know, ministers and, you know, his counsel, his advisor. And three questions were, you know, what is the most important time for me? And which is the most important time? Second, who is the most important person for me? And third, what is the most important thing for me to do? Now to make the story not too long, then each people, you know, each people made a different answer. You know, his finance minister made one set of answers, defense minister made one set of answers, everybody had their own, you know, priorities, so they all answered. But the king was not satisfied. He was not, you know, not so happy with any of his answers. Then he said, he threw these questions open to the nation and said, anybody who can, you know, answer these three questions in a satisfactory manner, I will give a big reward. And hundreds of thousands of men were there. But still, he was not totally satisfied with that. Then it became like his obsession. You know, he was always looking for somebody to give and, you know, the really satisfactory answer to these three questions. And then he asked people, anybody, is there any three wise men who can give me the answer to this question? And once you know, somebody came and said, actually, there's a very wise person in your own, you know, the kingdom. He might be able to answer the question. And he said, bring him immediately. He said, no, no, he's not like that. He's totally a recluse. He's in service. If the king army goes, he will just disappear. They will not find him. So he cannot be called. He's kind of a monk, an old monk in a remote, remote kind of place. Then he said, then I go, let's go now. He said, no, no, you can't go like that. Because if you go with all your, you know, retinue and things like that, then he will disappear and you will never find him. And he says, how can I get out there and find him? No. I must find him. And he said that if you really want to find him, you have to go to this guy. Disguise yourself as a farmer, and then you go and then you will find him. Maybe you will have the passion to get an offer. Then you will find him. So he did that. He put his, you know, and he says the ordinary. Ordinary farmer, and then he went and he took his guard that he put here, and then he walked himself on this mountain, and then on the top of this small mountain there was a little clearing, and there was a little house, and then this, you know, this rabbit, he was just, you know, making a kitchen garden just next his staff and working there. So he came and he greeted both preachers. And then he said, you know, I have three questions for you. I shall be very happy if you can answer these three questions. He said, what are they? Which is the most important time for me? Who is the most important person for me? What is the most important thing for me to do? Yes, he didn't answer, he just kept on digging the field. And then he was sitting there, waiting for the answer. But the answer was not coming. Then he was looking at the man, and the man was quite old and quite frail. And he was working hard, so he was really sweating, tired. So he said, you know, You rest a little bit. I will do something. So then he said, thank you, and gave him the tool. And then he sat down. And then the king did the digging. Digging. Then he said nothing. That was a little bit late. And then the king said, you know, I came with this morning, and I asked you three questions. Do you have an answer to this or not? Because then, if you don't have the answer, I have to go. Then the hermit said, oh, now, you know, you didn't help me so much. Now you sit down a little bit, and I have to do some more. So he took this thing, and he did it again, kept on digging, and there's the answer, and waiting. Now it's really getting late, you know, the sun is kind of almost setting. Then he said, you know, now I really have to go, it's getting late, you know, the sun is going to set, and it's only in a few minutes, and then, you know, I have to go a long way. Please tell me, what answer you have for these people? And around that time, they saw somebody coming out of the clearing, and he was running inside, and he fell down on his face. And then both of them went running to see the person. This person was shot by the arrow in his back. So both of them took him into his hut, took out the arrow, tried to save his life. And then, you know, it was too late, so he slept. But they could save his life. And then early morning he got up and he said, You know, yesterday I asked you some question. You know, now I'm going. Do you have any answer or not? He said, yes, but I answered you yesterday. He said, no, you didn't say a word yesterday. You know, what is the answer? He said, that's very simple, you know. He said, the most important time is now. And the most important person for you is the person who is next to you now. And the most important thing to do is try to have that person who is next to you now. And yesterday, he said, when you came to see me, that was the most important time for you. And I was with you, so I was the most important person for you. So you helped me to dig the kitchen garden, that was the most important thing to do for you. And then later on, when this man came in with his, you know, bullet with his hand, that was the important time for both of us. And this person was the most important person for both you and me. And he helped to save his life. And that was the most important thing for us to do. So it's very simple. And then he understood. And he was satisfied with his temper. When he came back and he ruled the country in a very wise way and had a nice, you know, country and nice king. And everything went well. Like pilot. So, you know, that's the thing, you know. It's very, in a way, it's very simple, you know. Now is the most important time for the fall. And what we have to, you know, what we have to do is, you know, be kind and nice to the person next to us. If we take that as our life, then we live life in a positive way. So therefore, you know, this is the, you know, of course, we can learn all the things, you know, 1, 2, 10 that, 20 that, 30 that, you know, all these things also. It's sometimes good to know all the things. Sometimes, you know, if you can't remember all of them also, the main thing is that. My diving is not so important. It is not really. It's funny, but there is nothing to learn from it. It's just that, what can you learn from it? Yeah, that, you know, I usually tell this story of my guy. By to understand that there is a big difference between, you know, what you know from your intellectually and how you know experientially. And all the practices like meditation and all these things is an experiential learning. So it's not, you know, intellectualized, it's experiential learning. When I wanted to learn how to drive a car, you know, to learn the theory, I already knew more or less, but then I read this book, you know, about it. I read it one day. The next day I went and I did it in America. You know. Actually, America is the easiest place to get the driving license. It's the easiest place. It's very cheap. I don't know that they change now at that time. But I think $10 for the learning license, and then $10 for the entry license. And they said that you cannot come more than once for giving test, once a day. So you should, you know, if you fail this morning, you cannot go back in the afternoon. But I was asked to come after 1 month. So what happened? You know, I was in Colorado, and I had a, you know, very nice, they gave me everything very nice, and then they gave me a car also, you know, red car, very nice one. And only 2 classes a week. So I thought maybe I should learn how to drive a car, you know, because I had lots of time and I had a car. So there were lots of people around who wanted to teach me. And I had many, you know, I had lots of teachers. You know, there was American teachers, there was Belgian teachers, there was German teachers, there was Norwegian teachers. There was even a teacher who taught people how to fly jet airways. So I got the learning license in 1 day, and then I started to, you know, and I don't learn, you know, I try every day, but not really, I'm not very diligent also, and then, you know, it doesn't work, you know. And then, after a month or so, I went for the test. So, you know, I'm parking my car like this, in between 2 cars. So now my examiner comes and takes next to me, and then he says, now let's go. So I said, should we go this way or that way? He says, go this way. So I'm taking the car out of this parking lot. And he says, be careful, you might hit the car next car, you know, because I'm going too much like. And I say, I saw it, and I did it. Maybe I already failed. But then, I went the way. Now I have to go into the main street, not the street, you know, big street, but street from the parking. So I stopped, looked up and down, and now, you know, I'm now on the second year, and you know, I have to go back to the first year. I didn't go back to the first, I went to the second year. And that meant another mistake. Then we went a little further, and now we can take more to the right. So now it's, you know, it's a big space, it's highway. So actually, I could go just like this, you know, this lane. But I stopped. I said, you can go by left. Now it's the highway, you know, it's you know, like 50 miles per hour you can go, in America it's miles, but I was going by 20 miles. I didn't know. Then he went a little further and he said, now go to the right, and now I should have stopped, because there was a red light. But I went on, almost straight to the accident. Then he said, maybe we should go back now. So he said, you know, to drive too slow is more dangerous than driving too fast. So it's like that, you know. So I got my license. After next time, I got an examiner who is even more kinder than this. He didn't even ask me to park. He just did. I think he knew that I'm not going to drive anymore. And from the moment I got my driving license, I never drove. So I'm trying to save the world. But I show it off. Every time I have a chance, I show off my... It's my show off. So I'm happy. So that's my story. So it's like that, you know, dream is very, very difficult. You know, learning, kind of intellectual learning in the dream is very different. And it's like the same, you know, sometimes people ask, do we need a teacher or not? It's like, I always say, it's like driving a car. To learn how to drive a car, you need to have somebody to teach you, you know, who knows how to drive the car. Nobody who's not knowing how to drive a car cannot teach you. And without a teacher, you cannot learn either. But the teacher cannot teach you like, you know, like this. You know, he can only show something and say something and, you know, kind of correct some of your mistakes. But, you know, I have so many great teachers. Even the one who was teaching how to fly aeroplane, he was very good actually. You have to be mindful. You have to see who is in the back, who is in the right, who is in the left. He was very, and then somebody who was letting me go back all the time, you know, back driving. That was very difficult. You know. And all of these teachers help, but you know, it's not something that you can just, you know, be taught about. So in the same way, I had lots of really great teachers in my meditation also. But, you know, that might help a little bit, but they can't just make me a great meditator. You know? So it's like that. It's your own, you know. We have to make the effort. We have to train. You know? Nobody can make us perfect. We have to train ourselves again and again and again, and then, you know, we kind of feel I will never be able to do that, but then one day it's a little bit better, you know, something. And then, you know, a little bit sometimes you can see, sometimes you don't see it, sometimes you feel that I'm getting worse and worse. Yeah? So it's like that, you know, whether it's meditation, whether it's driving a car, whether it's playing music, whether it's, you know, learning a language, it's also like that. So it's all the same, you know, practical things like that. So anyway, I think I should not talk too much. Talking is not good. So actually, originally this was a question and answer session. So if you have questions,
now the first question, going back to the topic of dying and the rebirth, that a lot of the people will have is, do we need to believe in rebirth? Because most of the Westerners actually don't believe in rebirth. So is it real, and do we need to believe in it? Just start off with easy question, you see.
Well, I mean, this is something that is what can you say? I cannot say exactly, you know, there is a nice difference, because my saying doesn't make any difference. Nobody has proved that there is no labor. That's for sure. There are some indications there is rebirth. There's lots of people who remember. I met myself, lots of people who remember, who say they remember their past life. Whether it's really remembering their past life or not, that's another story. They can't say exactly. But I was telling about this, this doctor, professor, Ian Stevenson. You have heard of him? You know, he really, he did so much research, and he's totally ignored by the scientific community. I think there is something there. You know, I think they cannot say anything against his research, because otherwise they would have said already. And because they cannot say anything, they keep totally silent. And he died this month, I think. And I didn't know about him either.
What was his name?
Ian Stevenson.
Ian Stevenson.
Yeah. I didn't know anything about him, but somebody wrote me that that would you give a talk about these things, because we have become very interested in Ian Stevenson's research on birthmarks. So I said, who is Ian Stevenson? I never know. And they said, you know, you should look up, because it's in the, you know, in the internet, and there are many books that he has written. And then I went, and it's very interesting. He has found a lot of people, and it's 3,000 or something like that, who not only remembered their past lives, but could be identified with their past life person. Some of them, they are close, not far away, you know, closer than in the family or relatives. Some very far away, you know, the families have nothing to do with each other. And then he tried to, those are okay, but then one thing that he thought was very important was the birthmarks. He studied the birthmarks. And he found some of them where, you know, like the child remembers that his former lifetime, he was killed by a bullet by so and so. And then he went to find whether that person really died in that way or not. And he found that person. And then he went to the court, the hospital for the autopsy. And he found that it's true, then the person was shot there. And exactly where the bullet was shot, and where the bullet was coming out. And then he looked on the child, and he found a special birthmark on the same place of the body where the, you know, where the gun was shot, and also another one where it came up. So there are many of these kinds, he found, that you know, the birthmark exactly, you know, the same way, the same place where you know, the previous person had something accident, or different kind of, you know, burn, or different kinds of, you know, weapons, things like that. So he wrote a book on this, the birthmarks. And that he thought was very you couldn't say anything else, but there's no other way to explain. So from Buddhist logic point of view, he said that you cut one bamboo and see that it's the hollow inside, then you look at all bamboos and you know that all bamboos are hollow, that you don't have to cut all the bamboos. So some people have been reborn, then maybe it's more likely that anybody is reborn. That's the kind of logic and reasoning. So it seems that at least some people are reborn. So that's the thing. But there is a taboo about rebirth in the West. You know, people get crazy, and you know, if you say I'm, you know, then is there something wrong with your mind? And you you're not supposed to see the doctor. But actually, the Christianity had the concept of river before. It was banned in the conference by the king.
Constantine,
or something like that. So there was the concept of river. And there's even that kind of expression still there in English. Some people say that, you know, I feel that somebody is walking on my grave, you know. And if you are not reformed, then who can walk on your grave? So there's some of these expressions that are still there. Yeah, so it's like that. But you know, whether you believe it, because if I believe it, it happens, and if I don't believe it, it doesn't happen. That's not like that. Lots of things I believe in, it is not like that. Lots of things I don't believe in, it is like that. So belief has not much
to do with reality.
Not all the time. It's not a democracy here.
I heard that in the States there was a church and a Buddhist temple next to each other.
Uh-huh.
And the church had a big sign that said, Jesus is coming.
Uh-huh.
And so the Buddhist temple put up a sign saying, so now you believe in rebirth. Does anyone else have a question here?
Yeah. Professor, you mentioned about in the Dharmata, the Bhagavad of Dharmata, that we should realize or recognize that there's nothing to run away from or run to.
Uh-huh.
And when we're living our life, do we also take that attitude? And if we try or we kind of recognize that, or you know, we get close to that way of living, like there's nothing to run away from or nothing in reality to run to, and then, you know, we kind of get into the dead end or difficulties of expectation of people surrounding us. You know, they expect us to have something to run to or run away from.
Okay.
So how do we cope?
So if I can repeat the question, because some people can't hear. He's asking about the bardo, the state of mind where, in between the rebirths, where you're supposed to recognize everything is illusion. Nothing to run to, nothing to run away from. So then he's asking that you see this in regular life also, right?
You know, this is like this. What other people want you to do or not is another thing. What you do or not is another thing. No? So when you realize this, your true nature, then you don't have fear and you don't have craving. So when you don't have fear and craving, you have done away you have done your own, you know, purpose. That's what it is. You have no more power. If I really done that away, fearing, craving, I have total peace. There is nothing, I don't need to do anything more. So I have done my own thing. I'm liberate. I have complete peace. Now, my only thing I need to do, I can do, is to help others. Isn't it? Because those, then, it is said that when you have that realization, your compassion for others becomes, you know, absolutely clear. Because so far, we say we are, you know, we are compassionate, but actually we always have our own things, you know. Because we have fear, we have when that experience comes, then we have nothing to lose, nothing to gain, you don't need anything in contemplation. So therefore, there's nothing else to do but to help others. And then, when you know that, you know, these people, all the samsari beings, if they just understood this, they would be free from all the problems. So, you know, there is possibility to free so much, you know, you would be so enthusiastic to help them. Yeah? So therefore, when that happens, you have complete compassion and you have complete wisdom. That's the idea. So now, what you have to do with the wisdom and compassion? Now you have to do, try to help other beings. But try to help other beings is not easy. So you have to do a little bit what they want to do. And in a way that is, you know, you don't have to, what can you say, according to the need of the people. Then if they want you to do something, you can do it. Yeah? And if they don't want you to do something, you don't need to do it. But, you know, you have to kind of live according to the way they do and do what they do. And you can't do something totally different from them. Otherwise, they will tell you you are gone mad. Okay? There's a story that once there was a king, and he was a very good king, and he got a kind of prediction that in 7 days' time there will be a man, and whoever drinks this water from the man will go mad. So he made a lot of efforts to make a well in his palace where no rain water would come in. So he only drank from this well. And so everybody became, you know, mad. Only the king was mad. But after some time, everybody thought he was mad. So everybody said the king has gone mad because everybody was mad. And so therefore, after some time, the king thought it's better that I also drink the same water. So he also drank the same water. And then he was cured from being mad. So.
Okay. Jabu, you have a question?
Yeah, I know you have a hospice training center in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And I see a lot of patients with cancer, some dying, some not. I'm curious how you address with people that are facing chronic terminal diseases.
Can everybody hear the question? Put your hand over if you can't. Okay.
I'm curious how you handle the issue of karma with something like cancer. I would never say it to one of my patients, you know, your karma. But with something like cancer, I get the sense that there is an element of, from the perspective maybe of taking responsibility for it and doing something responsible, you know, going forward. How do you, when you're training your people
at your center,
how do you address that whole concept of karma and sort of facing your mortality now?
I say like this. I said that every one of us will die, sooner or later. Some die early, some die later. And there is no certainty of that. If you are young, there's no guarantee you're not going to die. If you're healthy, there's no guarantee you're going to die. If you're sick, there's no guarantee that you'll die soon. Mm-hmm. You know? And if you're old, you will die, but not necessarily you'll die now. And so therefore, I said that, you know, there's no use to fear too much. You know, I try to reduce the fear as much as possible, fear and worry. Because that kills. I said that there is a saying that during the lifetime of a terminally ill person, thousands of totally healthy people die. it happens. So there is no reason, there is no certainty that I will not die, even if I have not cancer or nothing, tonight. So therefore, what I have to do is I have to live life the best way today. And if I die tonight, I have to be prepared for that. So the same thing for the cancer patient. That, like anybody else, we have to be prepared for that. And maybe it will happen tonight, maybe it happen after many years. Maybe we don't know. But you are not different from anybody else. So that's what I do. And I don't talk about karma, but karma is not... I don't see karma as a punishment and a reward. I see karma more, you know, from Buddhist point of view, everything is interdependent and dependently arising. There's nothing which doesn't come because of causes and conditions. So everything is causes and conditions, of course. So if you have cancer, it's because maybe you did, I don't know, you did lots of smoking, you did lots of drinking, you did lots of junk food, or, you know. Maybe you didn't do that also. Maybe there's, you know, now there's so much all these things in the air, you know, in the air, in the fields, in the, you know, so many things. So it's not, you know, necessary. You don't have to do it yourself. You know, there's some, you know, there was, I know a person, he always tends to ask that, you know. She has a husband who is a very good cook, 5-star hotel cook, you know, he cooks for me sometimes. And he was very particular about his health, especially about his health. So he and his three friends, they only drank, you know, the wine from, you know, the best kind of wine, this was so. They only took his olive oil, no butter, no. They all did this cycling every day, you know, so that they don't get, you know, problems. And this lady, his wife, didn't do any of those. And now, all three of these men got heart attack. And she has nothing. So, you know, it's like that, you know, it's, you can't say exactly. But what karma is karma I see it like this, you know. Of course it causes the effect everything that happens, but then, karma is more like, it's an experience. So what I am now, or what state of mind I am now, is because of the past. You know, all the things that happened to me, and the now is the result of all everything that happened to me, not only in this life, but all the lives before also. And not only, you know, when something very, you know, long time after, many lifetimes, but this life also, whatever I did in this life, whatever I had this life, whatever I experienced in this life, you know, including what I did yesterday and this morning and what kind of food I ate and all these things, all come together makes me what I am now. So what I am now is the end result of all my past. So therefore, this is something what I am now. That, you know, so I have to understand what I am now. There's nothing to blame anybody. There's nothing to, you know, it's just everything that happened to me has made me what I am now. Now the main understanding or main question of karma is, can I change? Can I make it better or can I make it worse? Yes, I can make it better, I can make it worse, I can change it, or I can just let it be like that, just carry on by the force of what happened before. So therefore, now if I want to change it, I can't just change it like this. If I want to become a Thai person. And this is Thai girl. I can't, it's not possible. Yeah. I'm only this old fat man. But, you know, I can make myself slimmer. Maybe little bit, if I, you know, if I eat less, then I don't have to be I have to go to Germany.
The food no good in Germany or something? Is the food no good in Germany?
Are there any Germans here? I read somewhere, you know, that the heaven is your car is made by the Germans, your food is made by the Chinese, your cook is the Chinese.
Cook is French, right?
No. In this way. And your salary is American, and your wife is Indian. That's heaven. But your hair is your cook is German. Your car is Chinese. Your wife is American. And your salary is Indian. I didn't say it.
To repeat your question, you're saying that you have to prepare yourself now.
Yes.
So how do you prepare yourself now? How do you prepare yourself now and reduce the fear element?
Now this is like this. First you have to accept the imminence of death. That happens to everybody, to you also. And it can happen any time, you know, because we have this kind of the illusion that because it is uncertain, because you don't know when it happens, so then we kind of think that it will not happen now. It will happen sometime, long time, but because we don't know when. But we have to know that this is not true. You know, the truth is that it can happen. And that becomes very important, because otherwise we don't, you know, we never get to that. You know? Now, once we are accepting that this happens, this can happen now we have to relate the word, you know, directly on. What if I die now? What is the problem? What makes it, you know, what makes it so traumatic? So therefore, you know, because I don't want to die. Yeah? But not wanting to die, is that, you know, does it make you not die? That doesn't make you not die. No. So therefore, you know, you have to, there are many levels of preparation. One preparation, the best preparation, is that you see the death, like we talked about. If you see your true nature, what is the death dying? Really, what is death dying in you? Who is it? What is it? What is yourself? What is the nature of it? So if you really understand this deeply, then you can totally clear the fear of your death, because you don't, you know exactly what you are and what is it to die or not. There's nothing to die or anything. That's what we call attaining the deathlessness. Now that, if you can, that's why people, you know, go into caves, go to the monasteries, go to, you know, long-term retreats and things like that, to find out, you know, and clear away with death fear. But then, if that is not possible for you somehow, then you at least do some good thing in that life. You know, say like, you know, if I look back into my life when I'm dying, you can see that I have done something good in this life, something positive in this life, that I am, you know, I am proud of. So therefore, I at least have no regret. So therefore, we try to prepare our life in such a way that even if I die, I have no regret. I have some good feeling that this is some good things that I have done. So that there is, you know, there is something that I can be proud of myself, I can carry with myself. So those are the, you know, things. So of course, there are many things to prepare, but you know. So this is also something that you need to think. What is it that I need to prepare for? What is it that I need to prepare for? Because everybody dies, and you never know when you will come. Fearing doesn't work. Fear doesn't, however much you fear, will not make you even delay your death. Fear doesn't do any good. And what we have to, this also sometimes excuses your fear, to understand clearly that, you know, what you have to go through, you have to go through, whether you like it or not. When you have to go through it, you have to go through it, whether you like it or not. So therefore, there's absolutely no use just panicking about it. Just panicking about it is no use. But doing something that's useful and purposeful in your life is something that will be useful for you.
I just want to share that in Jain tradition also there is a way to prepare for the death, and it is called Pralekhna. I mean, for many of you who may not be knowing about Jain religion, it is one of the very old religions from India. It is probably more than, our 24th teacher, Lord Mahavira, was contemporary of Lord Buddha. So in Jain tradition, there is a preparing for death is called Pralekhna. And in that, those who are terminally ill, or those who have to depend on other people, and they don't want to depend on other people, or they are old age, and they think that their death is near. So they actually leave all the attachment, and then they start preparing for the death in a very mindful way. So they start with reducing the intake of food, then they stop food and they start going for the liquid diet, and they slowly reduce that diet also. So this is not a suicide. I think people misunderstand that is a suicide. So this is a mindfulness preparation for the death, and this is done in a, many people even in today's time also do this. Particularly monks, they do definitely, but even the lay people who are older or very terminal ill, they also prepare slowly for this. So this way actually they are going to a very, what we call very detached life, which is to help to prepare for the next life, as we say that what we do now is for our future, and what we did in the past is our present. So this is a preparation for a better life in the next. So this is in a Jain tradition, it is very much there as even today.
Thank you.
just wanted to share.
It
okay.
is there, but it is not allowed by the Indian constitution and the law.
No, but isn't it like
self torture
also?
No, it's not
self torture. No, it's not allowed. It's very much accepted because it's a very old tradition. It's not something which people are doing as a suicide. It is like a preparing for the death in a very mindful way. So people do with full consciousness.
Yes.
So that's why it's not illegal as
such. No, it is illegal. It is illegal and banned in India. The last death, it was taken into the court.
Well, people,
okay.
people do that. Sorry,
it's not. It is a Jain tradition
yeah.
being followed. But in the last couple of months, there was a person who did it. And she was terminally ill. And she was very ill and very old. There was no chance of survival also. But despite it being Jain tradition, despite everything, this matter went into the court and the court decision was no. This is not assessment of suicide and it is not legal.
Okay.
I might mention
that if anyone's interested in learning about the Jain tradition, there's a very interesting course coming up this year, which is both in Bangkok and at Mahidol University. It gives you a good background on Indian thought. And Kun Pramod Jain, you have the leaflet?
I have some paper if somebody is interested.
So if anyone's interested in this course, grab... I think I'm going to do it this year, actually. It's very good. So grab one of these off him. If I can pass on to Dr. Thuisak here. You have a question?
Yes. May I ask a question? According to the Theravada school, the Tipitaka says once a person has reached the state of nirvana, that means there will be no cycle of rebirth. In other words, there is a complete extinction of body and mind, or the five aggregates that constitute a human being, all are extinguished. But according to the Mahayana and Vajrayana, they say still consciousness remains. Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
Then why there is a such big difference in the belief? Though we have the same Lord Buddha.
It's like this. When you become arahat, then there are two kinds of arahat. One is the arahat with remainder, one is arahat with non-remainder. The arahat with non-remainder, it is said like your all your suffering, all your causes of suffering, all the and everything, it will be like it lamp when it's fire is finished. Then it goes off. In that way it goes off. And then remains in peace. Now, there are lots of... Buddhism has lots of debate, you know. Many different schools of thought. Many different schools of thought, not only debates between Theravada and Theravadayana and Mahayana, but within the Mahayana schools also, within the Theravadayana also. That's why it is said that if you are, you know, if two scholars agree, one is not a scholar. But if two, you know, siddhas don't agree, one is not a siddha. Now this is explained like this from the Mahayana point of view, that all you go into complete peace, you know, and you remain like this in that complete peace for many, many long time, very, very long time, centuries. But because the subtle awareness, the subtle awareness is not the same. It is just awareness. It's only luminous. So therefore, there is not something that just dies away. So therefore, you know, when when the samsaric mind ends, then there is the wisdom mind. Wisdom mind which doesn't have any suffering or anything like that. But there is this wisdom mind, and that cannot totally, it's not dead. Because there's nothing to die. The nature of the consciousness in the subtlest moment, subtlest level, is nothing there to die, so therefore it doesn't die. So therefore there is wisdom. So this wisdom, now there's a lot of debate about what is wisdom and life, but so therefore this arahat also, then starts to work for the welfare of other beings and becomes a Buddha. Because we have two things in the Buddhist one is arahat and one is the Buddha. It's a little bit different, Every arahat is not a Buddha. When you look into the Sarvakayana teaching, then lots of arahats, a lot of arahats, but they are not called Buddha. The Buddha is, like Buddha Sakyamuni. So therefore, this is the idea of Mahayana consciousness, that the arahats then go on to become Buddha. It's not completely finished there. That's the difference.
So then consciousness never dies.
Consciousness never dies. Consciousness, the rough consciousness dies, but the subtle consciousness never dies. Yes, thank you. But this first, consciousness is the rough consciousness. It's subtle. There are different levels of subtlety. Of course, whenever there is consciousness, we have also body there. We always have the body with our mind. Like for instance, when we are dreaming, we have a dream body. There is no body, but there we have a kind of our own experience of the body. When we are in Bhado also, there is a Bhado body. There is no body, but there is a kind of thing. So therefore, when you are enlightened also, there is an enlightened body. Sometimes we call it Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, this kind of. So this is, the way it is.
I might say, when the Buddha was enlightened, the first thing he said was, I've discovered the Amata. The Amata is the deathless. So if he discovered the deathless, he cannot say that he dies and isn't reborn again. Because he discovered the thing that cannot die. And that was the first statement that he made in the Vinaya. So we also have the same idea that you discover something that can't die. If when you become enlightened, that's it, just dial tone from God, hang up, nothing more. Then that's not the deathless. Then you haven't discovered the deathless, because that's dying. So we have the same idea, sorry about it.
I think the deathless refers to the Dhamma never dies.
No, it's the attainment, the Amata. That the Aryan people had said that there is an attainment of the Amata, the thing that cannot die. And you get this by drinking the Soma juice. And the first thing the Buddha said was, I've discovered the thing that cannot die. Which means that element, he called it the deathless, the unconditioned. Again, the unconditioned, if it dies, then it has a condition. It wasn't unconditioned. So we have the same principle, that there is something there that doesn't die. I think, actually, Rinpoche is leaving early in the morning. Mm-hmm. And we have to feed him this evening. not German food. So on behalf of everyone, I'd like to say thank you very much for your time and your presence here in Bangkok. And we want you to come back again Next time you're passing through the area, we would very much like to invite you again. We have the two, Nat, if you can put these two donation boxes downstairs. We have a donation box for the final collection for Rinpoche, being a senior monk. He has a lot of dependencies, and he has the charity we talked about in Germany, and also the meditation centre in Sikkim. So if anybody wants to contribute to that, we'll put these two boxes downstairs as soon as we finish. In March, we have the trip to see Ajahn Jayasaro, the unlimited spaces, but if you want a space on the minibus, you have to come and see Ruby and give her your money to book a space on the minibus to go see Ajahn Jayasaro on Sunday the 6th of March. We have a final prayer here.
Yes, this is the dedication prayer, so it will be the last day, maybe we say this prayer. And we have it in English, so let us say it together. May all beings be happy, may all beings be from suffering, from creating the causes of suffering. May they find that noble happiness which can never be attained without suffering. May they attain universal impartial compassion, beyond worldly bias towards friends and enemies.
Excuse me, Pat.
Yes.
I'm about to spread a surprise on you.
Okay.
Members of the Bangkok Sangha want to express our appreciation for Venerable Pandit's leadership and his totally non-sectarian approach to Buddhism, which we all very much appreciate.
Okay.
And earlier last week, I was eavesdropping a conversation between Rinpoche and Venerable Pandit, and seeing that Pandit will be in India in April, and Rinpoche has invited the Venerable Pandit to come to his retreat center in the Sikkimese Himalayas and stay as long as he would like to. Problem is that Pandit is in Delhi and the retreat center is in Sikkim. So in this envelope is the means to be able to transport you from Delhi to Sikkim and return.
Okay.
We don't want to give it to you personally because in the past you're so modest that you decline all offers of donation. But if we give it to Rinpoche, then perhaps
we
might persuade you to
accept. Okay. Thank you very much. So I have to go now.
Yes. That's not for
another computer. Yes, not for the computer.
This is a beautiful
you'll enjoy. Yeah.
Come back.
So thank you all for coming, and there's still some coffee and things downstairs, so feel free to hang around, there's no hurry to leave if you want to stop and chat.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hope to see you soon.
Thank you.